Probably a fresher breeze, but similar temperatures. And after the rain, we should get some sunshine, I think, in Northern Ireland. And that'll be a welcome change after all the cloud and rain. Steve.
Darren, thank you. This is Radio 4. In The Unexpected Professor by John Carey, we followed the author from bottom of the class at school to Oxford Scholarship. Having gained a first, as did his girlfriend Jill, he proceeded to a number of postgraduate positions at different colleges. We rejoin his academic career as he begins a junior teaching post at Christchurch, reputed to be Oxford's most aristocratic and exclusive college. The reader is Nicholas Farrell.
I noticed that one of my Christchurch students had clearly sustained some damage to his left eye. Apparently, there was a tradition in Christchurch that on a certain night of the year, you would, if you were a young blood with a feeling for family history, try to smash as many windows in Peckwater Quadrangle as your father and grandfather had smashed when they were up. My student had been innocently making his way through the college when this mayhem was at its height, and a fragment of a tonic water bottle had bounced back from the wall into his eye, blinding him. What impressed me was his lack of resentment. He was from a public school himself, and his ethos seemed to be that young gentlemen would cut loose from time to time, and it was just bad luck if you were in the way. The whole episode was an illustration of Evelyn Waugh's famous reference in Decline and Fall to the sound of English county families baying for broken glass. But that was in 1928, and I'd not expected to find the tradition alive and well 30 years later. W.H. Auden was Oxford's professor of poetry at the time, and came over from America for a few weeks each year, staying in Christchurch, and quite often dining in college. He was the first great poet I'd met, and I'm surprised, looking back, I wasn't more awestruck. That was because he made things easy by being so unaffected. Getting to sit next to him at dinner wasn't difficult, because, curiously, no one else seemed to want to. I don't know whether the other fellows resented him as an intruder, or still bore a grudge about his staying in America during the war, or just weren't interested in poetry. One night, he talked about rhythm in poetry, and how his poems, or some of them, came to him as rhythms rather than as words or ideas, and how he had to find words and ideas to fit the rhythms. Auden famously likened his face to a wedding cake left out in the rain, but what I noticed more than his wrinkles was how he turned his head, slowly and carefully, as if it was someone else's head and he might break it. It was during this year at Christchurch that Jill, very courageously, agreed to marry me. We were married the following summer, just after I had gained my doctorate and been elected to the fellowship in English at Keble College. All colleges are different, but Keble was out on its own. One reason was that it was very poor. Once the rent for our flat had been deducted, my salary as a junior fellow was scarcely enough to live on. The other fellows were similarly disadvantaged by comparison with the rest of the university, and this bred a sense of isolation. The person who gave most thought to the college's public image was Vere Davidge, a law tutor, who was also the bursar and the uncrowned king of Keble. He hit on the idea of making Keble a great rowing college, and to this end, he admitted year by year as many of the Eton College first eight as possible. Inevitably, these young athletes could not always meet the usual entrance requirements, but Davidge used his influence and also sought out obscure courses, diplomas in forestry and such like, to which the less academically gifted might be admitted. He was quite open about this, referring to Eton jocularly as Slough Grammar, so as to suggest an intimate familiarity with the place. I was not overfond of Davidge, and he quite understandably loathed me. I'd been disconcerted when I arrived to find that Keble's main auditorium, the Pusey Lecture Room, in which all the fellows had to deliver their university lectures, was furnished with an assortment of ramshackle chairs and desks, which looked as if they'd been acquired at an elementary school's closing down sale. This seemed to me symptomatic of a general neglect of the academic side of college life, and I had pestered Davidge repeatedly to have the place refurnished. He always pooh-poohed the idea, insisting that there was no money to spare for luxuries of this sort, and I retired from our encounters baffled and seething. In my first year at Keble, the College 8 came head of the river, as usual, and permission was granted for a bump supper and a bonfire. Davidge's oarsmen were splendid creatures, wandering around the quadrangles like polar bears in their white flannels and blazers. And on the eve of the supper, one of them came up to me with a perplexed look and asked if I knew where they might procure wood for the bonfire. It seemed too good an opportunity to miss, and I replied, "Well, there are all those old desks and chairs in Pusey Lecture Room. It's high time they were disposed of," or words to that effect. Something akin to intelligence glimmered in his eyes, and he scurried off. I retired early that night, not being given to watching bonfires, but next morning I heard that it had been a huge success, a spectacular blaze, the best for many years, and everyone had had a wonderful time. The locked doors of Pusey Lecture Room had been beaten in at an early stage, and a party of jubilant polar bears, attended by eager assistants, had gone back and forth, carrying the old furniture into the quadrangle and committing every atom of it to the flames. Davidge was naturally furious, though as his oarsmen were responsible, there was little he could do except, of course, refurnish Pusey Lecture Room. I'd been teaching undergraduates for nearly 15 years, when Helen Gardner retired from the Merton Professorship of English Literature in 1973. The post was advertised, and I decided to have a go. When a letter arrived from the university registrar saying that I'd been elected, Jill and I were elated. But I was also a bit apprehensive, since accepting the chair would mean a considerable drop in income. I started reviewing in the mid-1960s. Poetry to start with, for Alan Ross in the London Magazine and Carl Miller in the New Statesman. When Carl became editor of The Listener in 1967, I wrote radio reviews for him until 1969, when he decided to switch me to television. I knew nothing about television. We didn't even have a set, so we hired one from Radio Rentals. I made dreadful mistakes at first, because I didn't recognize even the most famous TV personalities when they appeared on screen. People like bow-tied Robin Day, then a ubiquitous pundit. However, no one seemed to notice, possibly because no one read the column. When Carl switched me from television to book reviewing in 1974, the snooker was what I missed most. Our set was black and white. Almost no one had colour in those days, so the state of play was hard to follow. But I was gripped by the dramatic details. The waistcoats, the silence punctuated by tiny flurries of applause, the nervous sips of water taken by the player waiting his turn. However, we felt there was no point keeping our set, so we phoned Radio Rentals to tell them. The two men who came round were built like heavyweight boxers, evidently expecting to have to wrest their property from the bosom of a distraught family, unable to keep up their payments. They seemed disappointed we gave it up without a struggle. My worst mistake, if it was a mistake, was reviewing Ted Hughes's Shakespeare and the Goddess of Complete Being. I knew Hughes a bit and admired him enormously as a poet, so I was keen to review his Shakespeare book. The idea for it originated, he explains, in a dream. Shakespeare appeared to him one night, and when he woke, Hughes found he was in possession of hitherto unguessed-at secrets of the bard's life and works. I thought the whole thing was appalling nonsense. Hughes was a great poet, exquisitely attuned to the multiple meanings of poetry. What did he think he was doing, reducing Shakespeare's plays to this tedious, mythical mumbo-jumbo? Inadvisedly, I said all this in my review, and Hughes was furious. He wrote a long, angry reply. I wrote an equally angry response. That was in 1992, and I never saw Hughes again. But 5 years later, I reviewed his Tales from Ovid, a loose translation from the Metamorphoses, with lots of magnificent Hughes additions, which I thought one of his greatest things. In 1998, out of the blue, came a letter from him, enclosing a gift, a first edition of Sylvia Plath's Ariel, and enclosing, too, a cutout from a newspaper showing one of those psychological puzzles made of thousands of multicoloured dots which different viewers will see different shapes in. His letter was an olive branch, saying that we had disagreed only because we had seen different things in Shakespeare, like two people looking at one of these puzzles. I was shamed by his nobility, and wrote back at once with my own apologies. But he died before it arrived. His widow found my letter later, unopened. As well as reviewing books, I was writing some myself. The first was on Dickens, and then I wrote about Thackeray and John Donne. When Craig Raine joined the staff at Faber, he invited me to edit an anthology of reportage, a book which far outsold anything I had ever written myself. Some years later, my editor, Julian Luce, emailed me to say that William Golding's daughter wanted me to write a biography of Golding. I would have access to all Golding's working papers, including a private journal that he kept every day from 1971 to his death. I'd never written a biography before and wasn't sure I was cut out for it. Even calling it biography was, I gathered, passé. Among the conoscenti, it was now known as life writing. Naturally, because of Golding's eminence, the book got a lot of press coverage on publication in 2009. When I heard it had been shortlisted for the James Tate Black Memorial Prize for Biography, I immediately thought, I bet it won't win. And I was surprised I cared so much. I had done quite a lot of book prize judging, and the one thing I'd learned was that the result was largely a matter of chance. Since I believed value judgments were subjective, that was no surprise. Almost always, once the winner had been picked, I would think of other books that could just as well have won. Armed with these consolatory reflections, I travelled up to Edinburgh for the James Tate Black Awards, resigned to being publicly humiliated, but feeling it was my duty to go. I sat miserably in the front row while the chairman of the judges carefully analysed each of the shortlisted biographies in turn. His assurances that it was an extremely strong shortlist and that the losers should not be downcast were aimed, I felt certain, exclusively at me. I think I closed my eyes as a kind of defence mechanism when he drew breath to announce the winner, and when he did, it took a moment to sink in that my Golding biography had won. I was far more moved than was appropriate for someone who knew literary prizes to be meaningless. But then, academic matters apart, I had not won anything since the Richmond and East Sheen Grammar School for Boys cross-country run some 58 years before.
Nicholas Farrell was reading the final extract from The Unexpected Professor by John Carey. It was abridged and produced by Jill Waters, and it's a Waters Company production for BBC Radio 4. We'll take to the waters now. This is BBC Radio 4. And now the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 on Saturday the 5th of April. There are warnings of gales in Viking, North Utsira, South Utsira and Forties. The general synopsis at 1800, low 350 miles west of Rockall, 972, expected 400 miles west of Bailey, 971 by 1800 on Saturday. New low expected just west of Shannon, 987 by same time. The area forecasts for the next 24 hours, Viking, North Utsira, South Utsira, northeast 40s, southeasterly 5 to 7, occasionally gale 8, veering southerly or southwesterly 4 or 5, occasionally 6 later. Rain for a time, moderate or good, occasionally poor. Southwest 40s, Cromarty, Forth, Tyne, Dogger, southerly or...